you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we will tell you a story from what was known as the Great Darkness. The years in Quebec when Duplessis was premier, the Catholic Church dominated society, unwed mothers had very few options, and some untraditional occupations emerged.
My job is to smuggle black market babies out of Canada and into the United States. Yeah, I've been at it off and on the past 5 years. Maybe there's an easier way to make a bankroll, but I don't know it.
Today, the shocking story of black market babies. In the 50s, abortion was not just considered a sin in Quebec. It was also illegal. Orphanages were overflowing with abandoned children. Yet, they made it really hard for many parents to adopt. They practiced something called religious matching. Only Catholic parents could adopt these Catholic babies. Protestant parents, Jewish parents, any other parents, they could not adopt Catholic babies through official channels. While adopting from orphanages was restrictive, it was somehow not illegal to buy and sell babies. Not illegal in Quebec. All of this created the perfect conditions for Montreal to become a hub of international baby smuggling, a black market baby capital of North America. This is an underworld tale of a baby smuggling ring in which hundreds of Montreal newborns were bought and sold in the 1950s. And it's a family story, told by the families. As you're going to hear, both of our reporters today have personal connections to the story they're about to bring you. Like, very personal. This is a story about a secret that it took over 100 years and the advent of DNA testing to bring to light. It's a story about a part of Montreal's criminal history that became an international scandal. It led to an inquiry before the U.S. Senate. And I was completely unaware of all of this before Ilana Gordon and Adam Elliott Siegel brought this story to us. Wait for it.
Order, order. What is your name?
Eugene Harry Moyner.
Will you tell us some of your former occupations?
Yeah, I used to be a boxer, wrestler, weightlifter, and carnival man. But in a baby-selling racket, they call me the Pappy. My job is to smuggle black market babies out of Canada and into the United States. Yeah, I've been at it off and on the past 5 years. Maybe there's an easier way to make a bankroll, but I don't know it.
10 months ago, I had a baby. A boy. We named him Dylan. Last August, I left him for the first time when I flew from our home in Los Angeles to Montreal. I was looking for traces of Eugene Moyner, the man who, in 1951, made a living selling babies.
I came to Montreal in 1951. I wanted to buy a piece of a fighter, but the guy was a punk. My friend Harmonica Sam knew I needed to make a buck, so he took me to meet Sarah Wyman. Her business is selling babies to childless American couples.
What you've just heard is taken from the transcript of the 1955 U.S. Senate Subcommittee to Investigate Juvenile Delinquency. It's testimony from Eugene Moyner, ex-wrestler, ex-bodybuilder, ex-carnival huckster, spilling secrets on how to buy and sell newborns. I'd been reading these transcripts during my pregnancy. It's a story I got wrapped up in a couple years ago. The subcommittee's 240 pages of testimony are just a small part of my trove of newspaper clippings, court transcripts, and DNA research connected to the black market baby trade that was run out of Montreal in the 1950s. And for those of you really paying attention, you'll notice I included DNA in that list of documents tied to Montreal's baby trafficking rings. My DNA. Yes, foreshadowing. My family was involved, allegedly. In fact, my great-grandfather was once infamously known as the king of Babyland. We will get to him, I promise. But before we get to the king, let's start with the wrestler. Well, ex-wrestler, Eugene Moyner.
Now, how much money you make as a pappy depends partly upon the supply of babies and partly on how hard you like to work. But if you have good connections, you can do 2 deliveries a week easy. I'm not saying I did 2 a week, but I am saying if you can't do 2 or 3 a week, drop dead.
The hearing took place in Chicago and was chaired by United States Senator Estes Kefauver from Tennessee.
As long as we have people and greed and money, we will always have some crime. But as long as we stay on top of it, we can keep it at a minimum.
That's Senator Kefauver. In the 1950s, he presided over no less than 14 hearings focused on the mafia. At the time, Kefauver was famous enough to show up in newsreels.
The senatorial committee investigating crime in New York sets the stage for a new drama on its final day. Again, Frank Costello, alleged gambling czar, is the target for grilling. Again, he refuses to divulge his wealth on the subject.
These proceedings inspired the Senate hearing scenes that you might have seen in Godfather 2.
Mr. Pentangeli, were you a member of the Corleone family? Did you serve under Capo regime Peter Clemenza? Under Vito Corleone, also known as the Godfather?
I never knew no Godfather. I got my own family, Senator.
But in 1955, Kefauver opened a new set of hearings with a focus on cross-border, black market, baby trafficking. And that is when our ex-wrestler Eugene Moyner testified.
Up to this point, I know strictly from corn about babies. I know from nothing.
I get that his dialogue sounds like I ripped it from a Raymond Chandler novel or bottom-of-the-barrel film noir, but I swear this is actually the way he talked during the hearing and to journalists.
Here's something that not many people know about the baby business. There are leg men. We call them leg men, though some of them are women, who make it their business to find pregnant women who are not married. The leg men look for them in a million and one places. They meet them in bars and parks and cafes and all over. They hear things, you know? People talk, make with the chin, and this gal knows this gal, and that gal knows another gal, and that gal knows about another gal. The leg men send the gals in trouble to Sarah, and they get 25 or 35 if the gal agrees to let Sarah have the baby.
The Sarah Eugene Moyner is talking about is Sarah Wyman. And Moyner's bargain basement noir descriptive powers didn't fail him when describing her.
Broken-hearted gal over 50 that has a face like an accident looking for someplace to happen. She's never married, and she's not done so good with her boyfriends, and is all alone in the world.
Not the most flattering characterization, but the man knows how to paint a picture.
We're on Laval Street in Montreal's Plateau neighborhood, just blocks away from St. Laurent Boulevard, which is the north-south heartbeat of the city. Kind of the natural divide between the English and French-speaking parts.
I'm looking at Sarah Wyman's house. At least in the 1950s, it was the place where she bought and sold babies.
Sarah Wyman's home is one of a dozen or so maternity homes across Montreal in the 40s and 50s where black market babies were sold. And it's the one that was mentioned in the 1955 hearings.
That's Adam Siegel, a Toronto-based journalist who's been reporting on the black market baby trade for years. I found Adam online after reading a 2017 article he wrote about Montreal's baby trafficking ring. We've been corresponding over the last 2 years, chasing leads via email and speaking over Zoom to get to the bottom of this.
So I'm looking right now at a two-story brick building, and the doors are really nice. They're freshly painted. All the windows are freshly painted. Like, it just looks like a really nicely maintained city building, which is exactly the opposite of how it was described in the congressional testimony.
In 1951, a New Jersey dentist flew to Montreal to buy a baby. We can't tell you his name, at least not his real name. In his testimony before the subcommittee, he used a pseudonym, and the hearings went to great lengths to protect the identities of the family who bought the babies, as well as the women who surrendered their babies to the black market, even going so far as to have witnesses testify from behind screens. So, in 1951, a New Jersey dentist traveled to Montreal, to Sarah Wyman's place on the plateau, looking to buy a baby. When he appeared before the subcommittee to testify about that trip, he used the pseudonym Mr. Boyd. He told the subcommittee what he witnessed in Wyman's home.
We were brought into what is known as the slum area of Montreal. And coming up to this decrepit home, we had a very grave suspicion because the whole thing was up on the second story floor. There was a porch which was enclosed with canvas, so anybody up there could look down and see who was coming up the street. But any person coming up the street couldn't look up and see who was on the porch. We knocked at the door, and this grotesque woman appeared. She looked like a live character from the French Revolution. She had wiry hair, long knobby hands, and a faraway dreamy look in her eye. She was about the filthiest person anyone could ever conceive of. She led us up this rickety flight of stairs to a very dark apartment. The odor was overwhelming. There was no light in the apartment. And wherever you went, there was this filth and dirt. And I was quite upset because here I thought I was going to a maternity home. And this was the very, very opposite of anything a maternity home should be. There were no incubators, no oxygen, no sterilization. There was absolutely nothing in that home but a couple of chairs and a couple of beds.
Being at the dark heart of a transnational black market baby scam was just one of Montreal's sins in the 1950s. Forget Don Corleone and The Godfather. La Belle Provence had its own distinct society of criminals. The brothers Frank and Vic Catroni ran Montreal's mafia. They were connected to mobsters in Toronto, New York, Italy. Then there were the Irish gangsters, the West End Gang, who earned Montreal the title of Bank Robbery Capital of North America. The international trade streaming through the port of Montreal, the easy connections to New York, the porous border, meant Montreal was primed for smuggling booze, drugs, guns, and babies. Montreal's baby trade was infamous enough to draw the attention of the 1955 U.S. Senate subcommittee hearings that we heard from at the top of the show, and Wyman's place on Laval was at the heart of that testimony. Undercover Detective Teresa Heath took the stand to outline just how the black market baby trade was wrapped up in the city's other crimes.
I went to Miss Wyman's house posing as a cousin of a woman who wanted to buy a child. I met a baby girl born less than 18 hours before, but when I called Miss Wyman the next day to inquire about her, she told me the girl had been kidnapped. Miss Wyman was ill, so a friend came to take the infant to her own home. This supposed friend phoned later and said three men accosted her on the way home, forced her into a car, and after driving around Montreal for 2 or 3 hours, put her out and stole the baby. Miss Wyman believed this was a phony kidnapping, attempted by a rival group in Montreal's baby-selling racket, which later proved to be true.
Unwanted babies, the ones that didn't end up in legal orphanages, were in fact very much wanted by childless couples south of the border. Sarah Wyman and Eugene Moyneur were happy to help.
So a smuggler like Moyneur would pick up a parcel, a baby, at a place like Sarah Wyman's Laval Street home. Then, his challenge was delivering the package. But but it was no small feat to sneak an undocumented baby across the border. The smugglers didn't just have to watch out for the law. They also had to keep an eye out for other criminals who might, as we've heard, try to steal the baby. So for Moyner, it was cat and mouse from Montreal to Detroit.
I don't take any chances when I'm delivering a parcel, and if I think someone is tailing me, I turn a few tricks and I shake them. When I went over to Detroit, there was this fellow I had seen in Windsor tagging me. And I was to take a train to New York, but instead, I take a bus to Lansing. Then, I take another bus in Lansing and come back to Detroit. Then, I check in two different hotels and don't live in either one. I pay for the first hotel room in advance, and I pull the key. Now, they're sure I'm in room 316 with the baby, but I'm away from there in 15 or 20 minutes, and I check into another hotel and do the same. I stay in a private home, going on to New York on the train in the evening. So the finger who followed me, he has his headaches.
Moyner's black market stork service wasn't limited to the East Coast.
I've delivered babies to 9 different states and as far away as Florida and California. I delivered twins to Hollywood once. Right away, you would recognize the name of the family if I mentioned it, which I won't. I work out of Montreal, but I'm not the only one, and Montreal is not the only place they peddle babies. They go across the line from Quebec City and Toronto, too, and maybe other places, for all I know. I work strictly through an organization on the American side. I'll tell you how the thing works, but you won't get me making with any names. Because if I did, I would end up in a cement slab in the river. I like fresh air too much to cross the organization. So I get between $400 and $500 for delivering a baby, plus transportation costs. I pay the baby selling organization $130 for getting me over the line, but I usually take home a big tip from the couple that purchased the baby.
Even after they got their new babies home, parents had to stay vigilant. According to Moyner, fingermen would track down adoptive parents of black market babies and blackmail them.
I've known people to move completely from one state to another to try to shake off someone who's blackmailing them because of the way that they got the baby. Until they can get a legal adoption, they have to give some finger artist $100, $200, or $500, and they're too scared to go to the cops just in case somehow the kid will be taken away from them.
I started researching this story when I was trying to get pregnant. Now Dylan is almost a year old. During my pregnancy, I learned that babies can leave fetal cells inside their mothers, altering the mother's DNA. I think about this connection sometimes when my body wakes up a second before Dylan starts crying. I wonder if this bond ever goes away. I wonder if those birth mothers felt it, even after their children were gone.
I was never told I was adopted. I believed I was born to my mother in Plainfield, New Jersey. I found a picture of my mother, my adoptive mother, on a beach, and the photo was dated September 5th, 1951. She was in a bathing suit. So I asked her, "Why aren't you pregnant?" And she said, "Oh, somebody wrote the wrong date." That led to me starting to search the house and go through papers and everything. And I found a book in my mother's closet called How to Raise Your Adopted Child. We had a big fight. It was traumatic. I stole the car. I drove to Michigan to my mother's sister's house. I'd never driven a car before. I was a determined 15-year-old. I said, "Aunt Frances, tell me about my adoption." She goes, "Oh, they tried so hard to find your mother, but they couldn't." I said, "Where was I born?" She goes, "You ought to ask your mother."
When I began reporting on Montreal's black market baby trade, a lot of adoptees reached out. They contacted me from all across Canada, Florida, New York, Vermont. One of the women who contacted me was named Francine. Francine made the pilgrimage to see the spot where she was born.
We went to Montreal several times, and we went to Avenue Laval. We talked to the lady that lived in the place, and she goes, this used to be Sarah Wyman's maternity home.
Yep. Francine was born, or at least as a newborn, she passed through Sarah Wyman's Dickensian home. She was bought and sold to a couple in the U.S. Then, 70-some years later, she walked up the sidewalk back to that same house on Laval Street. And it turned out, she wasn't the only one. The current tenant says there's been so many people knocking on that door that she...
I almost moved because so many people with cameras and the newspapers have come here over the years and wanting to go inside and see the place. So she says, I must have met 20 or 25 of you that were born here. And so, you know, we just stood there and stared at the place, right?
In 1955, after Eugene Moyner named Sarah Wyman in the subcommittee hearings, a reporter from the Gazette came to her house to ask for a comment. Wyman said,
the girls were in trouble and they came to me because I could help them without any fuss or bother. I think I did a lot of good. I found nice homes for their babies and I helped the girls through a tough time. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
The entire time I've spent researching this story, I felt a vacuum where the birth mother should be. It's scary. Most have passed on and aren't around to answer questions about what they were thinking or feeling before, during, and after giving up their children. But three women testified for the subcommittee about their experiences with predatory adoption practices. They spoke from behind a projection screen and used false names to conceal their identities. And the differences between their testimonies give some insight into how diverse their stories were. One woman was subpoenaed and didn't seem to have any issues with her experience. Another testified that she gave her newborn up for adoption, but was later contacted by the lawyer she worked with. The adoptive parents wanted to return the child after learning he was blind in one eye. The third woman gave birth in a New York City hospital and had a particularly chilling story. She agreed to give her child up for adoption, but after the child had gone, she changed her mind and contacted the lawyer, saying she wanted her child back. Instead, the lawyer handed her a death certificate, told her the child was dead, and informed her he had made arrangements for the construction of a tombstone. It was only later that she found out the child was alive and healthy and had been adopted by another family. Adam says these predatory practices were used to prevent adoptive children from finding their birth parents.
They didn't have any legitimate paperwork to follow up on. They couldn't go to the government and say, hey, I'd like my birth certificate. And even if that birth certificate existed, it was forged upon birth. And that's how the lawyers circumvented the system, is that they created the adopted parents as the birth parents. They erased the birth mother, and it was a perfect crime.
Most of the black market babies never connected with their birth mothers.
I searched for years. I worked for the federal government. I worked for Department of Homeland Security. I had contacts. They got me the copy of the Kefauver hearings and everything. And I'm looking through it. I cannot find my father's name anywhere.
The hearings' witnesses' identities were hidden behind pseudonyms, but eventually Francine did enough detective work on her own to uncover her adoptive father in the transcripts.
And it turned out it's Mr. Boyd.
As in the Mr. Boyd. The same Boyd who we heard from earlier, the one who painted the picture of Wyman and the Dickensian squalor he saw on Laval Street. The New Jersey dentist who was outraged by Sarah Wyman and the condition of her maternity home, but who was desperate enough for a child that he bought one anyway. Mr. Boyd is Francine's adoptive father.
I think my father knew that what he was doing was basically not right. I don't know that he outright knew it was illegal. And it wasn't really illegal, as we know now from the outcome of the trials. But he knew that it wasn't quite right. He knew that you shouldn't be dumping $10,000 to get a child. I think he knew that. But he also knew that the adoption agencies in New York City and New Jersey were charging money as well for their service, but not for the babies. So I guess he didn't see a difference. And then he felt guilty, which is why I believe he testified.
As I worked on this story, my mind kept going back to this one moment outside Sarah Wyman's house. And what's hard for me to mentally work through is that some of the women who came here and gave birth and walked away, this was a maybe not a positive experience, but maybe one they didn't regret because it did allow them to forego the stigma and continue with their lives. It probably gave them a lot of relief. But I also have to imagine that for every woman who walked out and felt okay with this decision, there were women who walked out and just, I'm being emotional. Yeah, there were probably women who walked out and had to leave their babies behind when they really didn't want to. And I'm not a person who likes getting emotional in public, but as a new mom myself, I can't imagine how hard that was. Let me take a sec. Sorry.
You call bringing a baby in smuggling? If a little girl has a baby and she can't take care of herself, how the hell is she going to take care of a baby? There are always going to be people that can't have kids, and there are going to be gals that have them and don't want them. So somebody's going to get them together and maybe make a buck doing it. You find homes, and I will bring them to you. Just give me a living wage. I got to get by, too.
At the start of this episode, I hinted at my family connections to Montreal's black market baby scandal. How my biological great-grandfather was alleged to be at the heart of the baby smuggling ring? The doctor on call for the so-called baby farms? In our next episode, we'll dig into that story and how he was not only the alleged kingpin, but how he was also charged with kidnapping and murder.
And we'll also untangle the story of my own mother, who was sold on the black market.
If you'd like to hear our next episode, subscribe to Canada Land, and you can start listening to episode 2 now.
That was part 1 of Black Market Babies. Today's episode was written by Ilana Gordon, Adam Siegel, and Bruce Thorson. And it was reported by Ilana Gordon and Adam Siegel. The voice actors you heard reading testimony transcripts are Patrick DeNicola, Daniel Strauss, Derek Aegis, Kat Pergel, and Kaylee J. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Original music, audio production, and editing from Tristan Capicchione. Additional production assistance from Max Collins. I am the editor and publisher of Canada Land. Our theme music is by So Cold. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're talking about the news. Mostly, we will dare to ask, is there any silver lining for Canada to the Trump victory? Like anything? Anything at all? We may just have found something for you. Also, syphilis, measles, and scurvy. Oh, my. Why are people still getting Judy Garland-era preventable diseases in Canada? Finally, we will wish Mazel Tov to a Toronto Transit Project.